Yes, that's right.
Radio.
Okay, we are on with Fadi Handour. I just can't tell you all how excited I am that Fadi has been able to take some time today to join us and share some of his vast experience as an entrepreneur, as a business leader, as a social leader, as a visionary. I have known Fadi, I think, now for about 5 years, and we've had the opportunity to interact on a number of projects. In every instance, he has just been as gracious and supportive as anybody could be, and I know that there are literally hundreds and maybe even thousands of partners and entrepreneurs around the world who've benefited from Fadi's generosity and collaborative spirit. Fadi is the founder of Aramex. It's just celebrated its 30th anniversary. Fadi announced earlier this year that he will be stepping down as CEO of Aramex at the end of this year. He is also a supporter of Ruad in Jordan, which is a social venture that I think he will tell us some more about. He's been very involved in the World Economic Forum and the Schwab Foundation, other global organizations. He's spoken all over the world. He's known globally for his leadership and entrepreneurship. And so enough said. Wonderful to have you on, Fadi. We're going to start with just a few remarks, you know, sort of 10, 15 minutes of just comments from Fadi. I'm going to ask some questions, and then we're going to open up the line.
Great. Thank you so much, Phil. I hope people can hear me well. This is a very generous introduction from you. I am very excited to be here with you. So as you said, Phil, I'll speak for about 10 minutes. It's best that we keep this as interactive as possible. I have a specific theme that I'll be discussing now, which is the role of entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship and the private sector in development, and the importance and the strategic importance of the role of the private sector in development and in sustainable development in various communities around the world. So, but that will not be the only topic I would discuss, I guess. So it's open for anybody to raise any question that they have around this topic and around any other issue that they think is relevant for me to answer or address. So the basic theme here for me, which is something that I've been speaking about for years now, is that private sector, and specifically the entrepreneurial society and private sector, have a strategic and, in my view, a role that leads directly to their survival and their thriving, in fact, in their own businesses and in their own societies. So without them playing a role and a strategic role and a vital role and a critical role in the development and in bringing in their capabilities to the societies that they live in, then they're really falling into the trap that has led us to the financial crisis of 2008, which is not sustainable in any way, shape, or form. So I am talking about the really symbiotic relationship between the success of businesses and the success of entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship alongside the well-being of the societies that they operate in. A society that is not well does not create a private sector that is well. If we look at various countries that have had some of the revolutions in or the awakenings, if you want, or the change processes that has happened in the Arab world, we see a lot of blame going out to the private sector and some private practices that were not proper, or maybe, you know, or maybe from a rumor perspective, it's not proper. The private sector is automatically blamed for a lot of the things that is happening in any country. So the private sector needs to wake up and needs to understand that it has to operate in any country that it operates in any community that it operates in a sustainable manner. Sustainability in that sense means working for the long term, the profit maximization concept, the shareholder value of the purpose of an organization is no longer valid. Longer term means a thriving society by having the private sector participate in partnership, I would say, always in partnership with private sector, with public sector, and with the civil society. And I would say that tripartite partnership is so essential. So what does the private sector or the entrepreneurial community have that they bring to the table? I'm not talking really here about us bringing our capital and doing the traditional CSR, corporate social responsibility, PR stuff where we look good, but we don't really dig deep enough or do long-term projects that are, or long-term work, or our practices in general have to be sustainable. It's not about projects. It is about the way we work. It's a values-based leadership operation. So it's a holistic approach. It's a holistic approach where everybody benefits, the stakeholder approach to society. So everybody that gets touched by the private sector or touches the private sector needs to be part of this, and we need to understand that this is the only way for sustainable businesses in society. So we bring in our capital, we bring in our know-how, our skills, and we have a lot of those. We are a solution-based we have solution-based minds and ways of doing things in the private sector. So we are quite innovative in finding solutions for various issues, and we need to bring those capabilities into the public domain to address issues. Things like education, I would say, things like have a strategic value for us in the private sector. And if we don't participate in the decision-making in the public domain on how our communities get educated, then we are affected directly, not only for our own employees, but for the society as a whole that is around us. So an educated society around us is a society that is going to have a shared value with us, and then there is that virtuous cycle that happens there. So we also bring our networks. The private sector is extremely networked. So bringing in our networks to the public domain is essential, opening up doors for those people that are on the margins of society is so essential through utilizing our networks, whether within our own communities, within the countries at large, or within the global community that we participate in various ways, either through our own businesses or through the conferences or through our own contacts from our own travels. There's plenty of people that get best practices from all over the world, and we need to utilize those and bring them to the communities that we operate in. There's also the power of access from the private sector. So when people on the margins in our communities are not being heard, then it is our role in the private sector to make them heard so that we can address all these issues that they have, or participate in those in solving those issues, or bringing it up to the public employee that is responsible for that territory. I have found in many cases that a solution is as far away as a phone call to make people aware of that issue, and then you mobilize that community to come and solve those issues. So we also have employees. We are employers. So how do we bring in and benefit, for instance, youth? How do we bring in the private the youth that is just graduating into internships into the private sector so that they are ready for the workforce once they graduate from school? So, we become part of the education system by opening up our own systems for these people so that they get workforce trained, understanding what the markets need, how to actually participate in a corporation before they actually graduate, because there is fear sometimes among these youth in not understanding what is it that is required for them after they graduate. So we have, and we also are obviously are employers, and being employers, we also have, by definition, a social responsibility in the community. We're also, we have purchasing powers. How do we actually do our procurement? Do we have a responsible, sustainable way of procuring? Do we engage the small and medium-sized industries? Are we engaging young entrepreneurs that are popping up with new businesses in our purchasing power as private sector companies? So there is also that virtuous relationship in that process, empowering those SMEs so that they can create more jobs or they can become more sustainable from a financial perspective themselves. So that proposition in general is a proposition that says we need to move away from the mentality, and specifically in emerging markets. And you know, probably all markets are emerging nowadays, because there are, you know, even Europe today, as you can see, the youth unemployment in Spain is so high, and look at Greece, which is part of the euro. So boundaries of emerging markets are no longer the original boundaries that we had thought of just 2-3 years ago. So moving away from the aid mentality, from being the dependency process on outside aid to help us in our communities. Well, I'm not against aid in general, but I'm saying there is enough power, enough knowledge, enough capabilities, enough capital locally in any community, whether it's private sector, whether it's entrepreneurial society, to participate very actively, very generously in the development of their countries and their communities, so that they have a thriving community over there, and then thus their businesses thrive altogether. So the concept of thriving is not a concept of only a maximization of profit and only shareholders, but it is the thriving of the community and the well-being of the community that actually gets long-term sustainability for any business. So that's, in a nutshell, my theme today. And I have, you know, I have had various experiences and various engagements, and I have started various businesses or non-profits or social businesses that are in that field. And we think we have, you know, models that are on their way to proving that concept and showing the way for the private sector, that their interaction, their strategic decision to actually participate makes a difference on the ground. So that's what I have, Phil. This is a general introduction, just to open it up, and I'll take it. I'll take questions from you and from whoever is listening. Thank you.
Well, you know, I think the spirit of the words you've offered is really powerful, and it's all the more powerful because you've been living this message now for quite some time and in a lot of different ways. There's so many directions I'd love to take this conversation, but since we have a group of a diverse group of people who are participating in this course, but each of us in our own way self-identified as students, I want to bring you back to your days as a student, and particularly to your days as a student founding Aramex. I want to get back to the larger themes that you raised around the role of entrepreneurs in business and society. But just to kind of situate it, I wonder if you could share the story of the founding of Aramex. And actually, our good friend Ayn Khan, who's a student in this course and has been very involved, she had the same question for you that I had hoped to start with. So we're on the same wavelength.
Excellent, and thank you very much. And I think my thinking and what has shaped my worldview over the years is among many things, and probably most dominant is being an entrepreneur myself, being a young entrepreneur 30 years ago, graduating from college, and connecting with my partner, who basically came up with the idea and said, you know, why don't we start this new business? And, you know, being in the express logistics business, overnight deliveries was back then a very original concept. Federal Express was only four or five years old at that time. It has just established itself on the domestic scene in the U.S. market. So early stage, I was unable to, again, it was family and friends, capital, equity that helped us establish 3 or 4 partners we were at that time. Only 2 of us survived because people thought it was not, you know, a couple of other partners thought it was not sustainable to establish a business and compete with DHL. So my worldview revolves around a company that wanted to find a niche, wanted to compete with giants, because this is a giant-based business by definition, because being in the express business, you need to be global very quickly. And eventually struggling in finding more capital because banks wouldn't give you money. There was no angel investors at that time, or no venture capital, or even private equity. You had not, you know, private equity in the Arab world is a new thing that happened only in the year 2000 in this century. So we struggled early on. It was a continuously learning process. As you said, we're all students, and I continue to be a student myself. So I learned on the job. I struggled in finding employees that would work for a startup, traveling every single week if you want to go to every single country to find a partner that is willing to partner with a small company like ours to become our, if you want, agent in that country to deliver our parcel. So it was a struggle, a big struggle in the early days. But, you know, the key to this is that we found our niche. We found our niche. We decided that the best way for us to actually and the sustainable way for us to actually continue in the business is to partner with those big American companies that wanted to have their deliveries happen in the Middle East. And then the FedExes of the world, the Airborne Express, which no longer exists today because it got acquired by DHL, and many other companies that are not anymore even in the market in the US, like Burlington Northern, Emery. These were companies that only focused on domestic market, and we created a niche for ourselves by saying, outsource all your deliveries in the Middle East to us. And then what did this do to us? This created something that is very important for any entrepreneur, in my view, is that we learned from these suppliers, these people that were our clients, actually, not suppliers. These people, I learned everything that I needed to learn originally about the business and what the business requires from them. So I learned at the hands of Federal Express, Airborne Express. They introduced technology with us. We learned how the world operates in that space by actually totally integrating into their supply chain and into the way they think, and strategically positioning ourselves with them. So as we were getting paid to deliver their parcels, we were also learning how to actually build our business and go global with it. So a struggle of managing cash flow, a struggle of recruiting people, a struggle of introducing technology. And if you want, you know, if you remember, well, some of you won't, is that in the 80s, there was no internet. Internet is a product of the 90s. So we had to actually depend on technology that was mainframe based and very difficult to install in various emerging markets, specifically in the area. And then we had to face regulators. Why are you opening up a company that delivers letters and parcels when there's post offices and post office monopolies? And it took us years and years and years of actually knocking on the doors, finding loopholes in the law so that we are allowed to operate. Some countries took 14, 15 years to get licenses in. So these are all things and themes that every entrepreneur face. The key here is that, you know, believing in it, sticking to it, making sure your cash is always there, and never despairing. If you think you have a product in the business that makes that has value, then it eventually opens up. So it was, you know, Aramex, until we went public on NASDAQ in 1997. So from 1982 until 1997, we continuously, year after year, struggled in our cash flow. So it takes a long time to create a business that is actually sustainable and is cash flow positive. It's different from the world that we live in today, because in the internet world, everything is instantaneous. There is the need to exit very quickly. There is the need to, you know, build a business in 2 years and, you know, make hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars by selling it to the big guys. But these are only few stories, by the way. These are only few stories. The rest of the businesses have to struggle and have to actually build value for the long run so that they can remain sustainable. Not every entrepreneur builds his business just for exit.
So I'm just trying to put it together here. You had a new business model that had only been tried in the United States 5 years earlier.
no institutional sources of capital. You had major multinational corporate competitors. You had no real role models. And you had regulatory hurdles in every direction. Well, aside from that, what was the difficulty? It doesn't seem that hard. I mean, it's
look,
an amazing thing.
Look, we, you know, if I look back at it, you know, I'm glad my memory is fades away with age. So I remember that literally 14 years were years that where I've had difficulty sleeping many nights. This because I chose to be in a you know it's also not by choice but as such you know entrepreneurs are not always necessarily purposefully about you stumble upon ideas and it happened that my partner thought of this idea and we ventured into it and being stubborn enough to actually think you can make it when the world thinks you can't because you're competing with the DHLs of the world and who would have thought that you can actually go out and compete with such a powerful brand? But again, the niche, you know, luck also makes sense because these companies like FedEx and Airborne Express did not think that the Middle East was an area they wanted to be in. Were not even going international beyond the United States. So that was we found that this was the easiest way for us to actually establish the business because this gives you immediate cash flow. Because these people will give you a lot of packages that go to the Middle East that otherwise would have been delivered by your competitors. Because Federal Express, for instance, was giving their parcels back in the 80s to one of their competitors to deliver. They didn't like that. So we found that that niche works well. We said we are an independent company. We won't compete with you in your domestic market. And we will deliver your packages under your own name in these markets. And then, you know, and it took them 7-8 years to continue to work with us. And we were so dependent on that process. So again, there is luck and there is hard work at the same time, like every entrepreneurial story.
You know, I want to stick on that point for a moment. I mean, a couple of things you just mentioned. Since this is a global course, we have, in particular, many participants throughout the Middle East and North Africa and South Asia, many students coming from Pakistan. You know, you made an observation that the big multinationals weren't really looking to your region as an area for growth, certainly 30 years ago, that you use that disinclination and the perception, the negative perception in terms of opportunity, at least of the region, to your advantage, and use the scale of the multinationals actually as a way to grow rather than competing with them head on. I want to kind of take us a little bit into the present and say, do you see that sort of model is viable in other businesses and other contexts today?
Yes. Look, Phil, it's a great question. You know, I always tell my whoever wants to know that we're a product of the imperfections and the uncertainties and the risks that the Arab world is, meaning that because we're from here, our risk perception is different than anyone coming from the outside. So if you had looked at the Arab world back in 1982 or 1983, you would say, oh, my God, who wants to go there? Foreign investment laws were practically non-existent. There were civil wars in certain countries, if not, and wars among other countries, the Iraq-Iran war, civil war in Lebanon, and Intifada in Palestine, oil prices dropping down to $10 per barrel. Believe it or not, it was $10 per barrel at a certain time back in the 80s. And the regulatory environment that still is wanting here today, but even back then, you can imagine how difficult it is. But that's a fantastic opportunity for anybody that thinks that this is our own natural market and not thinking that you can make it. You can actually build your business here because that's where we come from. So it was business as usual for us, but it was high risk for others. So our risk tolerance, our risk view was different. And that we took as a competitive advantage, if we want. By the time the big boys thought that this is a market that's interesting, we were already a powerful brand in our market 15 years after we had established the business. So I would also suggest to anybody, look, the world did not change very much. Post-2008, the financial crisis, Phil, I would argue that many of these companies and many people have retrenched. Many people have thought it is an opportunity to go international, but many companies have retrenched and were looking at their licking their wounds in their own domestic markets. And many others don't want to actually venture. So if we don't want to talk about Pakistan, for instance, and Pakistan is a fantastic market, it has many challenges. If somebody looks at it from the outside, he says, you know, why the heck do I want to go to Pakistan? But for a Pakistani who's living in Pakistan, this is a fantastic opportunity to build your business and actually become the conduit for anybody that wants to come into your marketplace and build that value for yourself. So there are opportunities and risks. And in fact, the biggest opportunity comes in risk. Because when everybody is moving away from you, from your country, then this is when you actually build. When things have slowed down, it is easier for you to build your business than to build your business when there's a boom. Costs will go down, opportunities will open up, and you will be able to attract talent and not compete among a larger with the multinationals for the talent in your country. For instance, so there are plenty of opportunities, and I would say our success today is a direct result, Phil, a direct result of the difficult operating environment in our region in the first 15 years of our existence.
Well,
so plenty,
you know,
of opportunities
think,
there.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, and what you're saying just resonates so strongly with, I think, the sense that we've gotten from the students in this class and really the motivation of this course. You know, I want to just have one follow-up, and then we're going to start to open it up to the lines about this notion of the financial crisis. And, you know, generally, almost universally referred to in the U.S. and Europe as a global financial crisis. You know, I have some doubts about that, and I wonder what your comments are. You know, it's at the same time that we've had a global financial crisis, we've had this continuation of a process of growth and the sharing of economic prosperity in a global sense that has been unprecedented in human history. Which is the bigger trend? You know, the problems in Europe, the housing market issues in the United States, or this process of global growth?
Look, with the risk of sounding a bit condescending, which maybe people from emerging markets would appreciate. Now, I see no opportunities in Europe and the United States. I'm sorry. I think the definition of global needs to understand that global means global, everywhere in the globe. Global does not mean the West, does not mean the United States of America, and does not mean the markets that have already developed and established themselves. Global, in my view, is Africa. Global, in my view, is the Middle East. Global, in my view, is Southeast Asia. Global, in my view, is South Asia, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh. You know, these countries are growing. Aramex finds that our niche and our growth today and our global presence can, the biggest opportunities are in Africa today. In Africa, for people, you know, people would question some, you know, so what's in Africa? Small markets, regulatory problems, social issues. So what? You know, South Africa and the surrounding countries around it are growing and thriving. The East African market is opening up, you know, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, Rwanda are establishing a common market among themselves, and there's fantastic opportunities over there. So the concept of global means global in every single sense of the word. So if the West is not thriving, then we need to go to frontier markets and establish ourselves in them and grow in them. So we are, in essence, as Aramex, if you want, we are a global company. And we view our globality in terms of being global in emerging, frontier, growing, promising, developing markets. That's the definition of global. We exist in the West, obviously, so there's nothing anti-Western about us. We are in the U.S., we are in Europe, but the growth opportunities are here. So let me give you an example. Our first quarter of this year, we grew about 25% in our top line, and we grew about 25% in our bottom line. So and we operate in 65 different countries around the world. So there is growth around the world. So yes, there is a global crisis in terms of the dollar and the euro, but there are also a lot of economies that are actually changing, developing, evolving, and growing, and the opportunities are just massive.
So that's, I think that's such a great summary. I want to transcribe that and post it to my blog. So we will get to that, in the sense of what that means for everybody on this call, myself included. It's just really exciting what we can all do in the next 20, 30 years. And it will take that long, as Aramex has proved, to really build something significant. Really exciting. We have a question from Twitter from you. In the early days, when people were telling you that Aramex wouldn't make it, how did you find the courage to continue? Weren't you worried about failure?
Look, I worried about failure every single day, in the sense that I worried, what do I do next to make it happen and make this thing work? I mean, I never really let anybody question the survivability of the business, nor did I focus on them. So, yes, I would hear it. I would hear it from clients. Why? Who are you? How can you come and sell us a service when we have DHL? How can you deliver a global package? How can an Arab company be efficient, where the Arabs are known not to be time conscious themselves? So, all sorts of prejudices, even amongst my own friends, if you want. Why should I have your business and not give it to DHL? Why should I trust you with it? But, again, you focus on building the business. I was on the road for so long. I was spending 18 hours a day in my office focusing on building the business and not letting these people put me down. If you want to listen to people, you would sit at home and probably maximum read a book or do nothing. So I am, yes, I mean, entrepreneurs are not a special breed of people, but they are people who believe in the venture they're doing. If you believe in it, you won't listen to anyone. So I was not in the business of convincing anyone. I was in the business other than the clients that I'm to be trusted with their business. I was in the business of actually building the company and finding people to believe that this is a company that they can build their future in.
Now, I wanted to tie back to the themes that you started with. And really think about the role of a large company. We've been focusing on the entrepreneurial process, your experience
right.
as an entrepreneur, but you've also managed a very very large and significant company in the region.
Right.
And by way of a context setting, I was struck recently. There's been quite a controversy relating to the president of the University of Virginia, she was removed and then just recently reinstated. And a faculty member at the University of Virginia wrote a piece in Slate, and this is what this faculty member wrote. Wealthy board members, echoing the politicians who appointed them after massive campaign donations, too often believe that universities should be run like businesses, and this is the part that's significant to me, despite the poor record of most actual businesses in human history. And I just found that to be an astounding statement for anybody in an academic environment to make. How would you respond to this notion that business, first of all, has a poor record through human history, and second of all, that business is necessarily a force for exclusion and for the centralization of wealth in human society?
I think that's so ridiculous that I can't even think that it's a question that should be taken seriously. But I also see that it is a theme nowadays. So, again, the world, whoever wrote that letter, did you say the letter was written by university professors?
Yeah, a chair of a department, actually.
I'm not a historian of private businesses, but I would have thought that historically, in fact, the world revolved around private enterprise. the dominance of the public sector is an invention of the past 100-150 years, I would suggest. So so businesses over the years, from agriculture to small industries to cottage industries, were always in the private domain. So whoever assumes in history that the private private practice or private enterprise was bad has not read history, nor does he understand what private enterprise is all about. And then, besides, it's not about the multi-billion-dollar companies, nor the billionaires of the world that we talk about. And then, talking about the 1%, it is the private enterprise is about the SMEs. You know, they are the biggest employer, the small and medium-sized industries. They're the biggest employers, bigger than the public sector. These are private sector. These are entrepreneurs. I mean, the concept of big companies equating to entrepreneurs is wrong. I think there are few big companies and millions of small companies. I think there was a study recently, not recently, 2 or 3 years ago by the Kauffman Foundation that says every single new job in the United States was created by small and medium-sized companies or companies that are younger than 5 years, right? So so where does that concept come from? So the issue, I don't know if the university should be run like a private sector but or a private enterprise, but a university should be run to be sustainable. And sustainability has to have a financial element to it also. So the sense of entitlement and the sense of dependency of people that have worked in the public domain is also negative. You know,
right.
What are you giving back also? So it's not the dependency on the public sector in many cases has necessitated that you have actually outsourced your sustainability to an outside source which is in the public domain rather than being dependent on yourself.
Well, that's a wonderful response. I know I set you up there I knew what your response was going to be, and needless to say, I'm in full agreement, but I think you elaborated in a wonderful way. It wouldn't seem to me a question worth raising either, except that viewpoint seemed to be so predominant in the discussion over this presidency at UVA that
yes,
I was really
struck. I think it's very ignorant and it's very dangerous, because it is leading for future generations. Specifically, I see it here in our region. Have seen it historically. Is that there is that negative connotation towards the meaning of private enterprise, as if people in the private sector are not people from your, from that country, that don't care about the society. They're only vicious profit-seeking profiteers who are evil by definition. And that's so dangerous, because at the end of the day, if you think the public sector can absorb our youth into jobs and into becoming productive people in society, you are absolutely wrong. And if the youth are going to grow up and learn that private enterprise is evil and thus they won't venture into it, you are basically telling them, go become unemployed, because government is not going to be able to employ you. So you either live off the benefits of government, or you sit waiting for, or you work for a job that actually does not get you to grow, and you're stuck in the bureaucracy. So it's not for the lack of the fault of some of the private sector, the big private sector companies, like the banks that have failed in the U.S. that have led to this perception, but we can't blame the whole private sector world or entrepreneurial world. For those failures, we cannot take responsibility for the actions of the banks that were completely running uncontrolled.
Well, I mean, I certainly also agree that extrapolation from that context is a dangerous exercise. Now, there was a second reason I brought this up. I mean, first of all, because it's close to home, obviously we're
calling you from Virginia, and so we've been following this particular story. But there's another reason that I ask, which is that you have yourself been directly involved in creating opportunities through education, and I'm wondering if you could tell us the story of Ruad. You know, we have
so
20
Ruad,
minutes left.
Ruad,
you don't need to rush it,
yeah.
But I really would like to hear that story.
Ruad is a direct, is I think, in my view, again, this, I'm biased here, obviously, is a quintessential story of how the private sector, how the entrepreneurial society, how companies can actually bring their talent and capabilities beyond their cash only into development. So what we've decided to do with Ruad, and Ruad is an Arabic word which means entrepreneurs, and the organization is called Ruad for Development, or Entrepreneurs for Development, and that by it, and what Ruad does is exactly that. So we go to marginalized communities, and now we started in Jordan, now we're in Lebanon, we're in Palestine, and we are in Egypt, and we'd like to expand to other countries once Syria is better, and maybe Iraq eventually. So the concept is as such: the private sector has all the capabilities that I've spoken about in the opening of my discussion. We go to marginalized communities, and we are about bringing our capabilities into those societies to empower them so that they can stand on their feet and tell us, we don't need you now, we're independent. How do you do that? And focus on the youth. So we go into those communities, we offer scholarships. In return, every single person that gets a scholarship needs to give us 4 hours a week of volunteer time to work in his community or any project that he chooses that could be outside of the community to work on. So you need to log in 4 hours a week at least. You need to also participate in a discussion group for 2 hours once a week within the community to discuss on various issues that the youth bring up. You can, you know, over the years we've addressed every single issue you can, from religious issues to job finding to the financial crisis to the Obama speech in Cairo, etc., etc., etc. We brought in public sector officials to come to speak to these people. So again, making sure our networks and our connectivity to the public sector. So we brought in people from the education society, from labor ministries, from the most powerful institutions in the country to the police to come and address the issues of the community over there. So we've brought that. We also looked at all the deficiencies in the community. So we fixed schools. We established a health clinic in partnership with the Ministry of Health. The schools we fixed is in partnership with the Ministry of Education. We established a post office because the community did not have a post office. Again, employing locals in it, and in partnership with the Ministry of Post and Telecom. We've also established a small library, which is the first library in that community in Jordan. And now we're taking that model, obviously. Everything I tell you is going with us to in every country that we're establishing. And we open up the community for volunteers from the private sector to send their own people to come and volunteer their skills and capabilities. So we give English classes, we have a computer lab, everything contributed by the private sector, and bringing people from the private sector to contribute their time in that community. So it's not only about cash, the value is in the knowledge and in transferring that knowledge to those youth. And then the power of connecting the haves and the have-nots, reaching out and the learning on both sides. So people that live on the margins know that people that are well-off are giving back, if you want to call it that, and they're participating in the development process, and they feel that they are understood, or at least they're being connected with. And the people from the well-off community feel that they are no longer on the margins themselves and not participating in the development of their country. So it is a dual marginalization solution. So if you're not participating in development, you're marginalized, and if you're on the margins of development, you're also marginalized. So you connect both, and you have a very powerful, lethal, if you want to call it that, lethal, positively lethal combination that emancipates society, for that everyone feels that they are partners in this thing. Eventually, this led
So, you know, this is a seven-year-old program that started as a CSR, if you want to call it that, project at Aramex. And then Aramex and myself personally went out to the business community, and now we have, you know, tens of different businesses either giving us cash or giving us knowledge or giving us computers or contributing for tools for the schools and equipment for schools. So it is we've given out over 700-800 different scholarships up to date. We have a graduate program for the people that graduate from us, from our programs, to give back to their own community now that they've graduated. We do job placements, we do job advisories, we have a legal aid program where we have an office that gives pro bono legal advice from the top-notch legal firms in the country so that every citizen knows its rights. Today, we have had last year 900 different advice, and now we have the requirement is so powerful that even the lawyers that are contributing their time, they have become so empowered that they don't only give advice, they are actually taking cases to court and defending people that don't have anyone to defend them anymore. So, and there are so many other partnerships. And this is, you know, if you want a web of powerful partners from different parts of the community solving the issues of the community. And I would urge anyone to go to RUAD, RUWWAD.net.jo. Or .net, either .jo or .net, and then you'll find all sorts of really inspiring stories in there. So that model, which was based on the premise that the private sector has to be part of and parcel of that, is a power in and by itself today. We are sought after. We are, you know, we have interns coming in from all over the world that want to come and volunteer their work in RUAD today. And that's and it's only 7 years old, so there is so much more that. And we don't really spend hundreds of millions of dollars on it. This is only a project of people contributing anywhere from $20,000. Some contribute $5,000 to big organizations contributing $100,000, and you eventually end up with a community that feels it's no longer on the margins. So the model works. The model works. We've proven that it works. So what we need now is that this it spreads across different communities so that you end up with a sustainable long-term tripartite civil society partnership for development.
You know, I wanted to stay here for a moment because what you talk about, what you just referred to in terms of this dual marginalization solution,
right,
and what RUAD has offered to Aramex employees, you know, is very different. I mean, we, you know, we, those of us who kind of circulate in worlds that pay attention to this, you know that there's a general discussion about companies moving past, you know, what has been called corporate social responsibility. But just that framing, that corporations sort of extract and then they should give something back, is very different from what you're talking about in terms of this dual marginalization solution, that by creating this partnership, you're creating value not just for the communities that you are in which you're working, but also for employees at RUAD, at Aramex, and other corporations.
Correct.
I wonder if you could generalize on that. I mean, does that sort of a model create opportunities for the folks on this call?
Absolutely. I get that. I in the first TEDx in Palestine, in TEDx Ramallah a year ago, I gave a talk that exactly addresses that issue, Phil, and which is that marginalization does not only apply to people that live in the margins. If you're not participating in the development of your community, then you're also marginalized. So there is also that sense, for me, let me take myself or you or anybody that's capable and is concerned and
and lives in community and lives in a country and worries about the future of his country, you worry about the future of your children, then if you don't actually bring, and you have plenty of skills, whether you know it or not, everywhere, the concept here is that every single individual has plenty of skills. You just need to make sure that there is a platform for that skill to come and be performed, to help and to participate in the process of development. And because no matter how small it is, you can teach one student in one marginalized community how to speak better English and enable him to have a better job, and then you have actually succeeded in enabling one person who can basically bring in a family that that lives off and no longer lives in the margins. So the concept is those of us who are capable and have those intellectual assets and intellectual capabilities and financial assets who are not participating, then they're marginalizing themselves, and they are as marginalized as the people that don't have. So the concept of the haves and the have-nots, if you want, have changed from the people that want to participate in the development and the people that don't want to participate in the development. And I think Ruwad is a model to solve both issues. And that's I think that's the uniqueness and the power of it. And once you think, once your brain transforms the thinking from you giving back, the concept of giving back is also, I have issues with the word give back, by the way, because what are you giving back? What did you take? What is it that you took that you need to give back? It's not giving back. It is actually partnering. It is actually bringing in your capabilities into that development process. You're not giving back. You're actually giving something for yourself to graduate from that marginalization process. So it's powerful. It's quite powerful, and I've found some of the Aramex people that have actually participated in the process would come back to me and tell me, Fadi, I'm just going to thank you because you changed the way I view things in my own personal self. It's no longer about my job. This company gives me the ability to feel that I am part and parcel of the country and the community that I live in a meaningful manner. So we have, many people that have come up with small projects that you have this small skill. We have one person who works for us who's gone to the community and even established an office in it, and he recycles, he does a project, an art project from recycled material, and he employs people from the community and he trains people from the community and he gets them to sell these items back to people that have the money to buy them. So, anything. And then he found that, he's always had that skill, didn't know what to do with it, and suddenly once he found that the community can actually help him, he created a productive social business, if you want. So he doesn't want to make it for profit, but he is actually feeling that there is profitability in it.
We just tweeted out the link to the TEDx Ramallah talk that you gave, thanks to Sandy Maxey, right, who's in the course. I think it's going to be great to refer to that for an elaboration on this wonderful point you just made. And I should say, incidentally, Michael Youngblood and I, who are working on this course, have a meeting at noon, and it's really on a very similar theme, I think, for our region of this dual marginalization, and I really feel like it's such a powerful theme for everybody on the call. As we bring it to close, I'm just wondering, what kind of, you've offered so much in the way, I think, of practical guidance and avenues for opportunities. Is there anything else that you want to share for those folks who have tuned in now and for others who will listen to this broadcast later on, in terms of making the most of our historical moment individually as communities and in partnerships in the way you've described?
First, I want to thank you, Phil, for giving me this opportunity to speak to the group. My final comment here is I have found that my life, personally, take take me personally and many of the people that have worked with me and around me, their lives have transformed. You and the model with, that we came up with, and bringing in our in bringing in our capabilities and mobilizing people that are around us, our friends. I mean, you don't need to really do massive mobilization here. This is about just knocking the doors of 10 people that live around you and with you, and you connect with them every day in affluent societies, and telling them, you know, you can actually make a difference and change the community and change the country that you live in. And it changes your life. You find much more meaning to it. There is more a holistic nature to it. You feel much more comfortable in your existence. It gave me answers to many things. If you want beyond, because we all, you know, some of us that have been lucky enough to make it, all wonder what's next. What's next is actually bringing that knowledge and that capability and that luck that you've had over whatever period of time, and building your own career and your own business and taking it to the next level by sharing it with people who have not had the ability to share it. So by doing that, you're actually giving the most valuable thing that you can actually offer for anybody. And thus the virtuous partnership among people on both sides of the marginalized world.
Well, that's just great. I know that you know, I as I said, I've had the pleasure to know you for some time, but I've learned a lot of new things on this call, both about your own background and also about your ideas related to Entrepreneurs for Development. I know that you know, everyone on the call has similar feelings, and we'll have this available indefinitely for folks to tune into. So it'll add to the resources online that have, you know, communicate your vision on this topic. So thank you so much again for joining us, Fadi. It's been a great hour, and I look forward to the next time I see you.
Thanks so much, Phil. Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Okay.
Good luck to you.
Take care. Thank you. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Thank you.